Chapter 40. Share the profits. I wonder he didn't marry her and get all the property, said one. He may have been married already, and her cruel mortification may have been a part of her half-brother's scheme, said Herbert. Mind. I don't know that. What became of the two men? I asked, after again considering the subject. They fell into deeper shame and degradation, if there can be deeper, and ruin. Are they alive now? I don't know. You said just now that Estella was not related to Miss Havisham, but adopted. When adopted? Herbert shrugged his shoulders. There has always been an Estella, since I have heard of a Miss Havisham. I know no more. And now, Handel, said he, finally throwing off the story as it were, there is a perfectly open understanding between us. All that I know about Miss Havisham, you know. And all that I know, I retorted, you know. I fully believe it. So there can be no competition or perplexity between you and me. And as to the condition on which you hold your advancement in life, namely, that you are not to inquire or discuss to whom you owe it, you may be very sure that it will never be encroached upon, or even approached, by me, or by anyone belonging to me. In truth, he said this with so much delicacy, that I felt the subject done with, even though I should be under his father's roof for years and years to come. Yet he said it with so much meaning too, that I felt he as perfectly understood Miss Havisham to be my benefactress, as I understood the fact myself. It had not occurred to me before that he had led up to the theme for the purpose of clearing it out of our way, but we were so much the lighter and easier for having broached it, that I now perceived this to be the case. We were very gay and sociable, and I asked him, in the course of conversation, what he was. He replied, a capitalist and insurer of ships. I suppose he saw me glancing about the room in search of some tokens of shipping, or capital, for he added, in the city. I had grand ideas of the wealth and importance of insurers of ships in the city, and I began to think with awe of having laid a young insurer on his back, blackened his enterprising eye, and cut his responsible head open. But, again, there came upon me, for my relief, that odd impression that Herbert Pocket would never be very successful or rich. I shall not rest satisfied with merely employing my capital in insuring ships. I shall buy up some good life assurance shares, and cut into the direction. I shall also do a little in the mining way. None of these things will interfere with my chartering a few thousand tons on my own account. I think I shall trade, said he, leaning back in his chair, to the East Indies, for silks, shawls, spices, dyes, drugs, and precious woods. It's an interesting trade. And the profits are large? Said one. Tremendous, said he. I wavered again, and began to think here were greater expectations than my own. I think I shall trade, also, said he, putting his thumbs in his waistcoat pockets, to the West Indies, for sugar, tobacco, and rum. Also to Ceylon, specially for elephant's tusks. You will want a good many ships, said one. A perfect fleet, said he. Quite overpowered by the magnificence of these transactions, I asked him where the ships he insured mostly traded to at present. I haven't begun insuring yet, he replied. I am looking about me. Somehow, that pursuit seemed more in keeping with Barnard's Inn. I said, in a tone of conviction, "Ah, yes. I am in a counting house, and looking about me. Is a counting house profitable?" I asked. Do you mean to the young fellow who's in it? He asked, in reply. Yes, to you. Why, and no. Not to me. He said this with the air of one carefully reckoning up and striking a balance. Not directly profitable. That is, it doesn't pay me anything, and I have to keep myself. This certainly had not a profitable appearance, and I shook my head, as if I would imply that it would be difficult to lay by much accumulative capital from such a source of income. But the thing is, said Herbert Pocket, that you look about you. That's the grand thing. You are in a counting house, you know, and you look about you. It struck me as a singular implication that you couldn't be out of a counting house, you know, and look about you, but I silently deferred to his experience. Then the time comes, said Herbert, when you see your opening, and you go in, and you swoop upon it, and you make your capital, and then there you are. When you have once made your capital, you have nothing to do but employ it. This was very like his way of conducting that encounter in the garden, very like. His manner of bearing his poverty too, exactly corresponded to his manner of bearing that defeat. It seemed to me that he took all blows and buffets now, with just the same air as he had taken mine then. It was evident that he had nothing around him but the simplest necessaries, for everything that I remarked upon turned out to have been sent in on my account from the coffee house or somewhere else. Yet, having already made his fortune in his own mind, he was so unassuming with it that I felt quite grateful to him for not being puffed up. It was a pleasant addition to his naturally pleasant ways, and we got on famously. In the evening we went out for a walk in the streets, and went half price to the theater, and next day we went to church at Westminster Abbey, and in the afternoon we walked in the parks, and I wondered who shod all the horses there, and wished Joe did. On a moderate computation, it was many months, that Sunday, since I had left Joe and Biddy. The space interposed between myself and them partook of that expansion, and our marshes were any distance off. That I could have been at our old church in my old church-going clothes, on the very last Sunday that ever was, seemed a combination of impossibilities, geographical and social, solar and lunar. Yet in the London streets, so crowded with people, and so brilliantly lighted in the dusk of evening, there were depressing hints of reproaches for that I had put the poor old kitchen at home so far away, and in the dead of night, the footsteps of some incapable impostor of a porter mooning about Barnard's Inn, under pretense of watching it, fell hollow on my heart. On the Monday morning at 9:15, Herbert went to the counting house to report himself to look about him too, I suppose, and I bore him company. He was to come away in an hour or two, to attend me to Hammersmith, and I was to wait about for him. It appeared to me that the eggs from which young insurers were hatched were incubated in dust and heat, like the eggs of ostriches, judging from the places to which those incipient giants repaired on a Monday morning. Nor did the counting house where Herbert assisted show in my eyes as at all a good observatory, being a back second floor up a yard, of a grimy presence in all particulars, and with a look into another back second floor rather than a look out. I waited about until it was noon, and I went upon change, and I saw Flouet men sitting there under the bills about shipping, whom I took to be great merchants, though I couldn't understand why they should all be out of spirits. When Herbert came, we went and had lunch at a celebrated house which I then quite venerated, but now believed to have been the most abject superstition in Europe, and where I could not help noticing, even then, that there was much more gravy on the tablecloths and knives and waiters' clothes than in the steaks. This collation disposed of at a moderate price, considering the grease which was not charged for, we went back to Barnard's Inn, and got my little portmanteau, and then took coach for Hammersmith. We arrived there at 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and had very little way to walk to Mr. Pocket's house. Lifting the latch of a gate, we passed direct into a little garden overlooking the river, where Mr. Pocket's children were playing about. And unless I deceive myself on a point where my interests or prepossessions are certainly not concerned, I saw that Mr. and Mrs. Pocket's children were not growing up, or being brought up, but were tumbling up. Mrs. Pocket was sitting on a garden chair under a tree, reading, with her legs upon another garden chair, and Mrs. Pocket's two nursemaids were looking about them while the children played. "Mama," said Herbert, "this is young Mr. Pip." Upon which Mrs. Pocket received me with an appearance of amiable dignity. Master Lick and Miss Jane, cried one of the nurses to two of the children. If you go a-bouncing up against the bushes, you'll fall over into the river and be drowned. And what'll your pa say then? At the same time, this nurse picked up Mrs. Pocket's handkerchief and said, if that don't make six times you've dropped it, Mum. Upon which Mrs. Pocket laughed and said, thank you, Flopson, and settling herself in one chair only, resumed her book. Her countenance immediately assumed a knitted and intent expression, as if she had been reading for a week, but before she could have read half a dozen lines, she fixed her eyes upon me, and said, I hope your mama's quite well? This unexpected inquiry put me into such a difficulty, that I began saying in the absurdest way, that if there had been any such person I had no doubt she would have been quite well, and would have been very much obliged, and would have sent her compliments, when the nurse came to my rescue. Well, she cried, picking up the pocket handkerchief, if that don't make seven times. What are you a-doing of this afternoon, Mum? Mrs. Pocket received her property, at first with a look of unutterable surprise, as if she had never seen it before, and then with a laugh of recognition, and said, thank you, Flopson, and forgot me, and went on reading. I found, now I had leisure to count them, that there were no fewer than six little pockets present, in various stages of tumbling up. I had scarcely arrived at the total, when a seventh was heard, as in the region of air, wailing dolefully. If there ain't baby, said Flopson, appearing to think it most surprising. Make haste up, Millers. Millers, who was the other nurse, retired into the house, and by degrees the child's wailing was hushed and stopped, as if it were a young ventriloquist with something in its mouth. Mrs. Pocket read all the time, and I was curious to know what the book could be. We were waiting, I supposed, for Mr. Pocket to come out to us. At any rate, we waited there, and so I had an opportunity of observing the remarkable family phenomenon, that whenever any of the children strayed near Mrs. Pocket in their play, they always tripped themselves up and tumbled over her always very much to her momentary astonishment, and their own more enduring lamentation. I was at a loss to account for this surprising circumstance, and could not help giving my mind to speculations about it, until by and by Millers came down with the baby, which baby was handed to Flopson, which Flopson was handing it to Mrs. Pocket, when she too went fairly head foremost over Mrs. Pocket, baby and all, and was caught by Herbert and myself. Gracious me, Flopson, said Mrs. Pocket, looking off her book for a moment, everybody's tumbling. Gracious you, indeed, Mum, returned Flopson, very red in the face. What have you got there?
I got here, Flopson?
Asked Mrs. Pocket. Why, if it ain't your footstool, cried Flopson. And if you keep it under your skirts like that, who's to help tumbling? Here, take the baby, Mum, and give me your book. Mrs. Pocket acted on the advice, and inexpertly danced the infant a little in her lap, while the other children played about it. This had lasted but a very short time, when Mrs. Pocket issued summary orders that they were all to be taken into the house for a nap. Thus I made the second discovery on that first occasion, that the nurture of the little pockets consisted of alternately tumbling up and lying down. Under these circumstances, when Flopson and Millers had got the children into the house, like a little flock of sheep, and Mr. Pocket came out of it to make my acquaintance, I was not much surprised to find that Mr. Pocket was a gentleman with a rather perplexed expression of face, and with his very gray hair disordered on his head, as if he didn't quite see his way to putting anything straight. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.